Hi, this is Show versus the Universe. I'm not sure what episode it is. It's been a while. Sorry about that. I just lost my microphone. It's a very, very, very small microphone. And the smaller something is, the more likely I am to lose it. But I found it now, so I'm back. And I've got some things to talk about. This episode is going to be called the Chartist episode because in a while I'm going to go and talk about the Chartist movement. It's very, very, very important to know about. They don't teach it in schools. I know why. You'll know why in a few minutes. But firstly, I need to do my little review section where I just throw confetti in the air and then talk about some dark shit I've seen. This week, I watched The Act. I watched it all in one day. So that day was a very dark day for me. I knew about the case before. But then watching it, I was like, wow. Now, it's not very accurate to what actually happened. Like, the mum, Dee Dee, was way more physically abusive to her daughter, Gypsy Rose, than it showed in the programme. Like, she would beat her up, like, a lot. And the chronologicalness of it all is a bit mixed up. But, you know, you get the overall picture. Now, what shocked me was that Gypsy Rose got 10 years in prison, and her partner, Nick, who is the guy that actually did the murder, got 20 to 25 years in prison, I think. That shocked me a little bit because I'm thinking, well, he was clearly coerced. I kind of feel like they both needed to be put into mental institutions, to be honest, because he's got problems. He's got multiple personality disorder. He's got, that's not even called that. It's called DID or something, sorry. And he also has Asperger's. I feel like he'd be better in a mental institution than prison. I mean, you can put him in that mental institution for 25 years. I would have no problem with that. You know, he did actually murder someone. Gypsy Rose, on the other hand, she didn't actually murder someone. But the problem is, and this isn't her fault, but she's been raised in a way where she is now like a queen manipulator. She's learnt from the best, her mum. So I feel like she definitely needs some time in a mental institution just to sort of sort all that out. I keep saying mental institution, it sounds very derogatory. Hospital. She needs a hospital where she can go and get herself, you know, as close to normal as she probably ever can be. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like she was raised in a way that's made her a danger, not necessarily to the public at large, but to someone. Do you know what I'm saying? So that was my basic take home from that. Then after that, I went onto Reddit to look up people's opinions of the act, because I like to do that. Once you watch something, you go on Reddit or Twitter, Google the thing, or search the thing, and then, you know, read people's opinions. And someone was saying that they'd like to see season 2 of the act to be based on the text suicide case of Conrad Roy and Michelle Carter. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's a fucked up case. Honestly, it's dark, man. Don't go and read about that case if you're not ready to. Then again, I'm about to go into detail about it. So if you don't want to hear about suicide and stuff like that, just skip 2 or 3 minutes. I'm not going to go on too long about it. But basically, this girl, she met this... Michelle met Conrad in Florida, but they both lived in Boston, about a 40-minute drive apart from each other. They got into some sort of texting relationship. They'd say, I love you and shit like that. And they'd text each other all day, every day. But they only really met up like 4 times in about 2-3 years. So it was one of them ones. And then basically for the first couple of years, he was like mad suicidal. And she was like, don't. And she was trying to help him and make him not. And then at some point in May, June 2014, I think, she switched and she just wanted him to kill himself. She was making him. Like, he was like, she was like, when are you going to do it? And he's like, well, I've got to go to the beach with my mum. She was like, do it when you get back from the beach then. Like, that kind of thing. But all of that, according to the judge that presided over the case, because she opted out of a jury trial and went for a judge trial. I think she did that because she knew the judge would be like an old white man that would sympathise more towards the young girl. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, oh, she deserves a second chance. Da, da, da. Do you know what I mean? But anyway, this judge, when he came to like whether she was going to be found guilty of involuntary manslaughter or not. Yeah, he basically said, all that texting and that, you know, it was not cool and morally fucking bankrupt and horrible, but that's not what got you this charge of involuntary manslaughter. What done her was basically he phoned her, or she phoned him, they've got records of the phone call happening whilst he was in his car trying to kill himself. Now basically the method he was using would take 20 minutes, and they were on the phone together for 46 minutes. And then, like, she basically texted her friend saying that I don't know why she told her friend this, because she only did this. She only made him commit suicide so she could get sympathy from all of the friends at school that only ever wanted to hang out with her at school and not out of school. She was like a Billy no mates, basically. And she thought this would get her some mates. And she texted her mate saying, it's all my fault. He rang me and he got out of the car and I told him to get back in. That's what got her. That little bit there, that's what got her on the charge. I mean, she's only doing, I think, is it 15 months? Which I think is fucking stupid, man. She needs to do a lot. She needs to do the 10 years that Gypsy Rose Blanchard is doing. Real talk. If not more. Do you know what I'm saying? That shit fucked me up. I can't understand. And everyone, like, some people feel sympathy for her. And I'm like, no. And everyone's like, oh, she spent 2 years trying to not. And they're basically, the defence was saying basically that he made it an abusive relationship where he was like talking about suicide all the time to the point where it made her just have ideations about him committing suicide, which is very weird. I mean, I'm not going to say that's bullshit because they were both on Prozac. She had eating disorders herself, which, you know, kind of relates to some sort of trauma. So, you know, it makes you wonder, but again, like, what? 15 months? Ugh, that's disgusting. If honestly, if Conrad was my child, she'd be dead. And if I couldn't get to her, someone around her that she loved would be. Like, that's how I feel about that situation. It's just extremely fucked up. Right, the reason I'm wrapping up my reviews quite quickly is because this topic that I'm going to go into is really fucking in depth. I think it spans the years of, like, at least 50 years, if not more. The reason I learned about this and where most of my notes are coming from is because a few years ago I did an access course at the Open University, and this topic was on one of my modules. And at the time I was like, why is this not taught in fucking primary school? Like, this is such a great example of political protest. It's just great. And then I forgot all about it, as you do. And now, basically, I started my English degree, but I had to pause it for a while because because my mental illness went all sideways. But I'm starting it up again in October, so I'm basically trying to find all my old notes and get them all correlated and shit. And I found this again. I was like, yeah, let's talk about that. That's sick, man. So that's basically where a lot of my notes are coming from. It's things that I've written and also notes that I've made directly from the Open University. But they're open, so hopefully they won't mind. But yeah, a lot of it will be me just chatting about it. So you'll know when I'm reading out loud because it'll sound like I'm reading out loud. We know this already. So to start, I want to talk about how the Chartist movement came about. And to do that, I think we need to go back to, I think, 1815. We might need to go back further. It's going to be like a Tarantino storytelling. We're going to jump timeline a little bit, but only because of the way I've done my notes, like a fucking moron, basically. But yeah, we're going to start at 1815, I think. As the Chartists themselves knew, calls for political reform had been in evidence since the late 18th century. One of the reformers that they referred to was Major John Cartwright. He lived between the years of 1740 to 1824. He argued for universal male suffrage and other points of the future charter in his Take Your Choice journal that was published in 1776. Basically, you're going to hear a lot about journals and publications. That was their blogging, podcasting. Basically, that was their way of spreading the word. You know what I mean? That was their way of, like, yeah, talking to other people without the internet and stuff. Major John Cartwright, the guy who published Take Your Choice in 1776, continued to advocate for these principles up to his death nearly 50 years later. In mainland Europe, starting in 1789, the French Revolution had seen the overthrowing of the French monarchy and aristocracy. After that, there were like wars between Britain and France, tumultuous stuff. It was basically a shit show. And one of the reasons why the British elite resisted political change was that they feared a repetition of the events that happened in France. The wars with France ended with the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. The second half of the 1810s were a troubled time in Britain. This might sound familiar. Peace had been secured, but the economy fell into a severe downturn and the state tried to stifle signs of discontent by heavy-handed means. I wonder what that feels like. I know it's nothing now compared to what it was, I'm just saying, it's just a joke, sure. Faced with harsh economic circumstances and oppressive rulers, sections of the public turned to democratic reform as a solution to their woes. So, the years 1816, 1817 were important but difficult ones for a guy called William Cobbett. Who is William Cobbett, I hear you ask? I don't know either, but we're about to find out. I knew at a time, I just forgot. The massive demobilisation which followed the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, together with disastrous grain harvests of 1816, brought acute hunger and unemployment to the countryside. Wait, my people lived in the countryside? Huh. Wow. Anyway, Cobbett's response was launch a mass circulation broadsheet edition of the Political Register, in which he urged English workers not to riot but to pursue parliamentary reform as the great answer to their economic plight. The election of radical reformers to Parliament, he argued, would ensure lower taxes, fuller employment and increased earnings for all working people. So, you know, he's basically saying, let's fight them from the inside out, which is something that I technically agree with. I mean, fully agree with, actually. It's just, you know, at this point, they weren't playing fair. They really weren't. I mean, the aristocracy and the rulers weren't playing fair. The first edition of his register alone sold 44,000 copies in the first month. And Home Office records for 1816 to 17 indicate that its distribution was sufficiently widespread enough to cause great concern to the government, particularly to the Home Secretary, Lord Sidmouth, who early in 1817 rushed several acts through Parliament in an attempt to reverse the growth of public support for parliamentary reform. Fearing incarceration because of new measures, William Cobbett set sail for the United States and arrived in New York on the 5th of May, 1817. Having taken a lease on a Long Island farm, Cobbett lived a quieter life, but he continued the Political Register from abroad, as well as writing more books and treaties, most notably the Agricultural Treaties, A Year's Residence in the United States of America, published in 1818, and his widely selling Grammar of the English Language, 1818 again. This latter work, which William Cobbett saw as a testimony to the intellectual capacity of himself and of the common people as a whole, was intended especially for the use of soldiers, sailors, apprentices and ploughboys. Accordingly, Cobbett cheekily drew his examples of faulty grammar from the writings and speeches of such renowned political leaders as the Duke of Wellington, Lord Castlereagh and George III. The English grammar continued to be used in English schools into the 1920s and 30s. When Cobbett returned from the USA in October 1819, his personal and political fortunes were at a low ebb. He was bankrupt and lost his farm as a result. The flight to America had damaged his relations with other leaders of the radical movement, most notably his ally Henry Hunt, who had remained in Britain during Sidmouth's repressions and stoically endured a prison sentence. Nonetheless, William Cobbett believed he brought with him, in the form of the bones of Thomas Paine, a powerful and emotive symbol around which all parliamentary reformers could rally. But it was not to be. After the Peterloo Massacre of August 1819, a new cast of radical leaders began to emerge. And then basically William Cobbett just didn't last as a, you know, popular person. He was a bit downtrodden and everyone was looking down at him, like, how could you escape when we were all suffering, that sort of thing. However, Cobbett's fortunes began to improve, chiefly because of the increased circulation of the Register, which resulted from his involvement with the Queen Cardine affair. A lot of these things, like the Peterloo Massacre and that, yeah, I'm just going to assume that you're going to go look into them. If you want me to go into them at a later date, I will. They might even come up at later points, but this Queen Cardine affair, don't know what it is. Don't know. But, yeah. William Cobbett's biggest thing was the distressed state of English farming. It was his single most greatest concern throughout the 1920s. Sometimes to the irritation of local landlords and farmers, Cobbett would make uninvited appearances at country meetings where he sought to convince landholders that the only solution to their post-war economic distress lay in radical reform of Parliament, which by 1820 he saw as entailing nothing less than universal manhood suffrage. It was partly to spread this message and partly to strengthen his knowledge of rural England that Cobbett now undertook and celebrated rural rides. Most of them between 1821 and 1826, describing his purpose as to hear what gentlemen, farmers, tradesmen, journeymen, labourers, women, girls, boys and all have to say, reasoning with some, laughing with others and observing all that passes. So he was basically going on a jolly around the countryside, just seeing like, yo, what do you want? What is it you want? What do you lack in life? What do you enjoy? Like, basically, like, a random, you know, like, when you self-refer for therapy through a charity and they make you tick these boxes, like, how happy are you? One of them, innit? That's what I'm picturing, anyway. From 1828 until 1830, William Cobbett frequently warned the government that a major rural revolt was in the making and that steps should be taken to ensure that rural workers were amply provided with employment opportunities and living wage and the full protection of the poor law. True to William Cobbett's predictions, the southern rural workers arose in rebellion during the Captain Swing disturbances. What a name. Of 1830 to 1831, the new Whig government of Lord Grey, suspecting that suspecting that Cobbett had helped to foment this rising, put William Cobbett on trial in 1831 for inciting rural workers to commit acts of violence and incendiarism. I mean, you can understand why Lord Grey would think this, because man's been going to them going, you know them rural workers down there, yeah? They're pissed off, they're going to come for you. And then they come for you and you're going to be like, he told them to. Where was I? But William Cobbett, conducting his own defence, received an acquittal when the 12-person jury could not agree on a verdict. Cobbett's national reputation was now enhanced. Yay! He's back on top. Even some of his supposedly quirky opinions, such as his claim that the rural workers of southern England would rather be hanged than live on potatoes and tea, were now found to constitute part of the platform of the Swing rioters. Would rather be hanged than live on potatoes and tea. Fam, I love potatoes. Anyway. Immediately in the aftermath of the revolt, William Cobbett used his political momentum to agitate for the Reform Bill of 1832, though on this matter he enlarged his constituency to include anyone, whether landlord, farmer, banker, or merchant. He worked closely in 1831 to 1832 with a Birmingham banker, Thomas Atwood, who was prepared to support the terms of the bill, even though the proposed enlargement of the suffrage fell far short of what Cobbett and other radical leaders had hoped for. So to surmise, he basically had a bit of a, what do you call it, an underdog moment, where he started off his career as writing this big political registrar blog that was extremely, I keep calling it a blog, it was a journal, extremely popular, got everyone in the working class, well not everyone, but a great deal of the working class at least thinking about political reform. And then he went to help out, you know, the rural people, which, you know, England back then, there was a lot of rural people. And I think his biggest downfall was when he ditched to America for a bit. And I think everyone, especially everyone that stayed behind and took prison sentences, would look at that and go, where were you when we needed you? Like, where were you? I thought you were ride or die. You're not ride or die. At least that's what it comes across. Even now, looking back on his whole life as a whole, I would say he's not a ride or die person. He just isn't. He'd probably snitch on you. But, you know, he tried. He did his thing. So that's William Cobbett's attempt, which leads us up to, I think, 1832-ish. I just want to quickly and very briefly talk about a guy named Samuel Bamford. He released his autobiography in 1844. It was written in the 1840s. And he'd been involved in the campaign for parliamentary reform in the late 1810s. So around the whole time we were just talking about, Bamford conveys several things about the origins of public support for democratic reform. The support seems to have been concentrated in manufacturing communities. Cobbett's writings appear to have been very influential. Rising levels of literacy, which was taught by Sunday schools, enabled people to engage with ideas of parliamentary reform, and working class people are shown to have acted as agitators for reform in their local communities. So basically, Sunday schools in them times were making the everyday man and woman a lot more literate than what they used to be. So these new blogs, journals that were being released, and autobiographies and that, people were able to read them, take in information and start to go, you know what? Yes, let's do this political reform thing. So it started to agitate a lot more of your everyday people. You know, just think of the whole Brexit movement, except right instead of wrong. Let's not get too political. She says, and she's talking about a massive political movement. Ah, but yeah, you know what I'm trying to say, innit? Back to Samuel Bamford. Bamford's personal involvement in these developments gives his account authentically. But what we've got to bear in mind is the fact that this is one source by one guy from a very particular locale, written over 20 years after the fact that it happened. He wrote this biography 20 years after what he's writing about, which all autobiographies are like that. But, you know, again, we have to take this as a one person, one source thing. We can't just say, oh, his word is, you know, bond. He discusses in his autobiography one of the most infamous events that occurred in these years at St. Peter's Field in Manchester on August 16th, 1819. A crowd of over 50,000 people had travelled from the surrounding districts to hear the radical speaker Henry Hunt, the guy that was pissed off at William Cobbett before, because Henry Hunt took a prison sentence and Cobbett pissed off to the United States to be a farmer. Anyway, they were unarmed people and orderly, but such was the paranoia of the times that the authorities overreacted badly, with the cavalry charging into the crowd. 11 people were killed and hundreds more injured. This was a date remembered for years to come by radicals as Peterloo, you see? A play on the word Waterloo. I did wonder why it was called Peterloo. It should have been called, like, St. Peter's Field Gate or something. I don't know, but Peterloo fits. That's, yeah, I think they got it better than me. Don't let me name things. In the early 1820s, the economy recovered and popular protest receded. Obviously, as the economy recovers, people are less hungry and agitated, so they feel less need. But protest was revived by 1830, by which time the economy was struggling again. Crucially, a change of government from the Tories to the Whigs in 1830 held out new hope of electoral reform. The Tories had stood for keeping the old electoral system that had been in place since 1688. The new Whig government was prepared to modify it, although they did not want democracy. Spurred by this, radical groups in the country renewed their protests. So basically, the Tories were dead set against any sort of political reform. Duh. But then the Whigs took over, so everyone was like, yay. But then the Whigs were like, no, actually, we're not going to do it either. So everyone was like, ugh. Anyway, there was no national organisation for these protests, but there were impressive local associations such as the Birmingham Political Union, which could summon crowds in the tens of thousands. Threats were made of revolution if change did not come soon. In the autumn of 1831, there was a wave of riots in support of reform, most notably in Bristol, but also in London, Nottingham, Derby, Worcester and Bath. Worcester and Bath. So Bristol, London, Nottingham, Derby, Worcester and Bath. See how Derby's doing its thing. Anyway, sorry about that little outburst. Actually, you know what it reminds me of? You know them fucking grime MCs? They're like, Liverpool, Manchester, Derby. Sorry. Right. When electoral reform did come with the Whigs Reform Act of 1832, it was to prove a great disappointment for the radicals. Only prosperous middle-class males who owned property above a specified value were added to the electorate, which on one estimate was increased from 5% to 7% of the adult population. The ordinary masses were left out. New constituencies were created in industrial towns, which have been greatly underrepresented. Wait a second. The ordinary masses were left out. New constituencies were created in industrial towns, which have been greatly underrepresented. What the fuck, Michelle? Underrepresented in the old system, but this still left the industrial working classes without the vote. The radicals' disillusionment intensified in the years that followed. They took part in widespread protests to try to reform working conditions in factories, but Parliament resisted their demand to limit the working day in factories to 10 hours. Worse still, in 1834, Parliament enacted the reviled new Poor Law, which tried to force the able-bodied poor to live in workhouses if they were to be given relief. There was an extensive radical protest movement against that too, but without success. In the mid-1830s, the economy prospered, but radicals hoped that if there was another recession, it would be possible to stir people into a new agitation for electoral reform. So basically, it's a big song and dance where you need people to suffer in order to get that reform. And when the economy is booming, you know, they're not getting the political reform that could... I mean, they need that... What I'm basically trying to say is that when the economy is booming, people have food, they're not really stressing that much about trying to achieve more. They're happy with what they've got. But when the economy is struggling, the first people to get hit by that are, you know, the everyday people, the country folk, the working class, the poor folk. Do you know what I'm saying? So what the radicals are saying, which is, you know why they're called radicals now, is that, you know, we want these people to suffer a little bit more so they're more inclined to join our radical movements in order to get the political reform that would give these people more say, regardless of whether they had food or not, which would then mean that they probably would have greater periods of having food because, you know, they could knock down the aristocracy a bit. So yeah, that's basically where we're at so far. I need a wee. I think it's worth noting as well, there's a guy, Birmingham's leading exponent of parliamentary reform, Thomas Attwood, argued that for the masses to get behind parliamentary reform, they need to be motivated by an economic downturn that threatened their jobs and wages. So, you know, that's basically what I was saying. So I got that right, I guess. From 1837, though... the economy did begin to falter, and in 1838, the campaign for democratic reform was reborn as Chartism. Finally, 30 minutes into the podcast, and we're finally at Chartism. However, this time it would be different. Sounds like a, however, this time it would be different. Yeah, I should choose that tone. Choosed. Ugh. Anyway, in 1832, reform had been secured by one of the main parties in Parliament, the Whigs. W-H-I-G, by the way. While radical sections of the public put on pressure from outside Parliament, now it was a matter of grassroots popular movements taking on the Whigs. The Conservatives, the new name adopted by the Tories from the early 1830s, big fact for you, and the whole political establishment. The extent of popular protest would be considerable. But the united opposition of the two main parties in Parliament and the forces of law and order would prove to be much harder to defeat than Attwood had hoped. Attwood is that guy from Birmingham that said, you know, people need to starve in order to fight for what they need. Clearly, Chartism was able to build on support for parliamentary reform, which had been increasing for several years. Chartism was not created from scratch in 1838. It was basically built on the back of giants. There was a well-established tradition of radical protest in favour of democracy, which found expression in popular journalism, blogging, local groups, mass meetings and riots. There were also signs that popular support for such reform tended to peak during times of economic hardship, for example, the protests of the late 1810s and early 1830s. It's of no coincidence that Chartism began during a crucial point of economic downturn of the 1830s. So between the years of 1837 to 1842, the destitute swelled the support for democratic reform in the hope that a new political system might bring different social and economical policies which would provide a relief from their sufferings. When looking at the beginning of the Chartist political movement, the obvious place to start is the creation of the People's Charter. The Charter incorporated long-established principles of radicalism, which had been advocated by Cartwright as early as the 1770s. Don't know who Cartwright is, might have been mentioned earlier. In 1837, the London Working Men's Association organised the drafting of these principles to create the Charter. William Lovett was a leading light of radical politics in London. Leading light. How poetic. And after much discussion, the final version was approved by the LWMA on 8th of May 1838. So to surmise what I just said, the People's Charter was created by the London Working Men's Association, written by William Lovett, and its final version was approved on the 8th of May, 1838. Approved doesn't mean approved by Parliament. I mean, they said, yeah, that's the list, let's send it out in their little blogosphere. Very quickly, the initiative passed to radicals based elsewhere in Britain, especially in the industrial north. Soon after the charter was finalised, it was being advocated at large speaker events, which attracted crowds in the tens of thousands, an early sign of the extent of public support. The summer of 1838 saw a series of such meetings, most notably in Glasgow, Scotland, which was so early that copies of the charter were not printed in time. So basically, Glasgow had this massive meeting. They were that enthralled by what they'd read of this people's charter. They didn't even have the time to print out the charter for people coming to the meetings. Bless them. Very, very eager. Eager beavers. Oh, they also happened in Birmingham and Manchester as well. But by that point, they had printed a charter for people that was attending the meetings. Building on the established tactic of holding large rallies, which had been a staple part of popular radicalism throughout the 1830s, Chartism started in full fight. In these early months of Chartism, two strategies were adopted to persuade Parliament to adopt their charter. The first was the collection of a great petition of signatures which would be presented to Parliament. The second was the creation of a general convention of representatives which would stand as a democratic contrast to Parliament. Both of these strategies would be central to the Chartist movement for its duration. Pointedly, neither strategy involved the direct compulsion of the existing authorities. The hope was to persuade the state rather through the moral force of the protest made. However, there were also threats that if the state did not comply, there could be a resort to physical force, whether in the form of strikes or armed insurrection. For Chartists, the right balance between moral force and physical force protest was always a difficult issue, with some distancing themselves from direct physical action, whereas others were ready to contemplate it. So with any radical movement, you've got them that are more radical than the others. They're basically saying to the Whigs and the Tories, listen, we're going to try and compel you to do right by appealing to your morals, but if that don't work, we're coming for you. And then some of them were like, are we really going for them? Yeah, because my back hurts and my knees are not as good as they used to be. I don't really, you know, I got kids, man. Do you know what I mean? It was one of them. And then some of them were there like, let's just do it now. They're never going to come and do what we want them to do based on their morals. They have no morals. Let's kill them now. I don't know if they planned on killing them, but you know. Anyway, one person emerged quickly as the foremost champion of the Chartist cause, Fergus O'Connor, an Irish barrister. Oh no, barrister, not a coffee maker, a law person. Who claimed ancestry from the kings of Ireland. Oh, wow. Oh, what a catch. He was a strikingly impassioned public speaker. You know what? I'm in love already. Oh, whose strong and clear voice would carry to thousands of listeners. Despite the lack of modern amplification. So basically, a man could throw his voice around a room. Same as me, mate. I've got a really loud voice. Does anyone else think me and this Fergus O'Connor were really well suited? Gosh, if only he was alive today. It is said that he could connect with a mass audience like no other radical curator. And he travelled repeatedly around the country to spread the message. Oh, mate, I'm like so in love. Anyway, his other major contribution was in setting up and maintaining the weekly newspaper, The Northern Star. Launched in 1837, it soon became the main voice in print of the Chartist movement, providing the latest info about Chartist meetings to readers across Britain. Fam. Can we just stop and talk about him? Fergus O'Connor. He's a barrister, right? So a good wage. Claimed ancestry from the kings of Ireland, strikingly impassioned public speaker, strong and clear voice, wrote his own weekly newspaper. Oh, I'm quivering. Anyway, yes, please, more of him. Yeah, so the first peak of Chartist activity occurred in 1839. It was a year of mass meetings and threats of strikes and uprisings if change did not come soon. The first general convention of Chartist representatives started in London on the 4th of February, my best mate's birthday, later transferring to Birmingham, like the heart of the country. It makes more sense. More people can get to Birmingham. In May, it emerged that the first national petition had secured 1,280,959 signatures, at the time the largest single petition on record. The first national petition was presented by Thomas Attwood to the House of Commons on the 14th of June 1839. Some weeks later, 12th of July, the Commons rejected his motion to consider the petition by 255 votes to 46. Attempts by some Chartist groups to respond to this with armed uprisings met with disaster. The most famous of these was the uprising at Newport in South Wales on the 4th of November. An armed force of 5,000, armed, marched on Newport, but at the Westgate Hotel they were met by a detachment of infantry who opened fire. More than 22 Chartists were killed and around 50 wounded, while the rest fled. The leaders of the rising were originally sentenced to death, but this was later changed to transportation, aka they got shipped off to Australia. Throughout the country, the state's response to the wave of planned uprisings proved to be ruthlessly effective. Hundreds of Chartists were arrested and detained. Lovett was sentenced to 12 months in prison in August 1839, and O'Connor, the guy that I just fell in love with, to 18 months in prison in March 1840. This was despite the fact that O'Connor and the Northern Star, his publication, had been taken by surprise by the Newport Rising and had been slow to support it. See, he was even wrongly convicted. Oh my God. Anyway, this could easily have been the end of the Chartism movement, but it says a lot for the resilience of its public support that it was soon regrouping and preparing for another campaign of protest. One important means of renewal was the founding of the National Charter Association, NCA, on the 20th of July 1840 to give a coordinated lead to local groups. In the months that followed, hundreds of local branches of the NCA were set up across the country. See, that's how you do it. That's how you do it. And that's why I feel like the Chartist movement is so important to teach children. I would say in probably year 5, year 6, year 7. So between the ages of like 9 and 13 would be a prime age to learn this. Because they're starting to come into their own sort of rebellion. I know because I've got a 12-year-old child at home who's rebelling like fuck. And I feel it in my bones. So, you know, it would be a good time for them to go into looking into rebellion. Because they'd be into the whole idea. And then to see how you... You know, they say that they teach history so that we can learn from our past mistakes. Well, here's a prime example right here, and we're not teaching it. Anyway, ran over back into actually teaching the thing. The economic depression remained severe up to 1842, so there was no let up in the public's yearning for change. Yeah, see? O'Connor, our little god, our little Irish god, love him, was released from prison on 30th of August 1841, an event remembered for years to come through the words of the song The Lion of Freedom. There's a song for him! Fam! Guess what, I'm YouTubing in a minute. Oh my God. Anyway, the song The Lion of Freedom. In October 1841, the NCA agreed to the creation of a new political national petition. It acted together with the Northern Star, O'Connor's journal, and the local NCA branches to set it in motion. This takes us up to 1842, the time of Chartism's next big push. Its ultimate expression was the presentation of the second national petition to the House of Commons on the 2nd of May 1842. The fact that the number of signatures was so much greater this time, well over 3 million, reflected genuine popular sentiment. But none of this stopped the Commons from rejecting the petition. See, they tried again. They got over 3 million petitions, signatures, which, again, we're talking an England without telephones. You know, this was all taken place by associations setting up and branching off into little local branches. That's how they get the information distributed. That's how they get people to sign the petition. This is how you do it, folks. This is exactly how you do it. Once again, I mean, it didn't work, but, you know, we take from them, we learn, we take the torch and pass it forward, isn't it? That's how it goes. Once again, the aftermath saw a desperate resort to physical force protest. Whereas in 1839 there had been attempted uprisings, in 1842 there was a strike wave, which was especially strong in the industrial northwest of England. Starting in July and fading out in September of 1842, the strikes were motivated in part by savage wage cutting by local employers. But intermingled with this were recurring political cries of the Charter or no return to labour. Oh. The strikes were known as the plug plot. I'm the plug plot. Yeah, never mind. For the way in which the removal of plugs from boilers was used to stop the steam engines that drove industrial activity. Oh my God. Wait. The strikes were known as the plug plot for the way in which the removal of plugs from boilers was used to stop the steam engines that drove industrial activity. Seize the means of production, bitches. Crowds of strikers marched from one town to the next, trying in each place to turn other workers out on strike. Hence the strikes were called turnouts. So it was like a plague of strikes, really. Which is only good, isn't it, really? From our point of view, we're like, yeah, bring the motherfucking ruckus. How is this all so exciting to me? In the end, the strikes failed disastrously. As in 1839, O'Connor, my little boyfriend, and his fellow Chartist leaders were taken by surprise, and this outpouring of grassroots activism and were slow to support it. Gradually, the strikes broke down, with the strikers lacking the financial and organisational resources to sustain a long turnout. The forces of law and order were able to reassert themselves, and there were mass arrests, convictions and imprisonments. So basically, O'Connor and all them, they built up such a buzz that, you know, when this thing didn't go through the parliament like everyone, all these 3 million people expected it to, these 3 million people were angry and were starting to strike, and it took the main leaders of the Chartist movement a minute to realise what was happening. And by the time they realised and tried to back the strikers, it was too late. The strikers were already running low on resources and that, and, you know, the law and order basically took over and won again. So that was a bit of a shame. This might have been the end of Chartism, especially as economic conditions were recovering by 1843. But the Chartist movement carried on, which suggests that there was more to its support than the simple reaction to economic hardship. Chartism, one might say, had become a living community with a network of local groups, meetings on a regular basis and sustained by the regular flow of information from the Northern Star that was written by my boyfriend John O'Connor. Something O'Connor, I think it was John. Forgotten his name already. Even though the campaign for democratic reform was put on hold for a few years, there were other goals to sustain the movement, such as O'Connor's land plan, an ambitious scheme for workers to escape economic exploitation by moving to specially created rural communities. See, my man is on one, you know, because I've always said I wanted to set up my own rural communes. I call it communes, he calls it communities. Tomato, tomato. Chartism's final test came in 1847 to 1848. In July 1847, O'Connor was elected MP for Nottingham. That's just down the road from me. From an Irish king ancestry to an MP of Nottingham. A shock result. I'm shocked. Later that year, economic distress raised its head once more with a terrible harvest and high grain prices. The Chartist leadership decided it was time to collect another national petition. Then, starting in February 1848, there was an extraordinary series of uprisings across Europe in which regime after regime was successfully toppled, though most were to regain power within a year. Could Chartism do the same in Britain? So it looks like in the late 1840s, Europe had its own like spring. You get me? Like, we had the Arab Spring recently. It's like the European Spring in the 1840s. Could Chartism do the same in Britain? The answer was no. On the 10th of April, at a mass meeting at Kennington Common, O'Connor, my boyfriend, proclaimed that the third national petition had amassed 5,700,000 signatures. But after the Commons officials received it, they calculated that the true figure was just under 2 million signatures and argued that a number of these were obviously bogus. These charges were widely publicised and seriously damaged the reputation of the movement for anyone who looked to it for a moral lead. Now, it's probably propaganda though, to be honest. There followed a summer of mass demonstrations and attempted Chartist uprisings. These protests should not be underestimated, especially in Bradford, which was in turmoil towards the end of May, with crowds of Chartist supporters overwhelming the police and an order only being restored by the military. Jesus Christ. However, in 1832, the end result was a government crackdown, many arrests, key Chartist leaders and agitators being imprisoned or sentenced to transportation. After this, the hope and momentum that had kept the Chartist movement going was hard to sustain. Parliament and the forces of law and order had remained firm throughout and had eventually worn down many of the protesters. An attempted national petition in 1849 gained only 53,000 signatures. Further attempts in 1852 mustered only 11,000. Chartism continued for some years, sometimes rallying and showing signs of vitality, but the glory days were gone. What I probably should have said at the start of this was, on the petition there were like 6 points that they wanted the parliament to sort of take on board, and these were the 6 points that just kept getting voted down, not taken seriously, to the point where Chartism died out. And these are the 6 points that they wanted. One, universal male suffrage. I mean, in them times, female suffrage, I mean, as a female back then, you couldn't even buy a house or anything. Like, if you were a single woman back then, it was bad. Very, very bad. Number two, no property qualifications for MPs, so you didn't need to own properties to be an MP, which means, you know, more diverse MPs. Annual parliaments. Again, I don't know if that means annual general elections or annual local MP elections. I think the latter is more likely. Four, constituencies of equal size, whether in terms of inhabitants or voters, because obviously voters, it wouldn't have been everyone allowed to vote. So a lot of, that's a problem with a lot of leftist movements. They tend to splinter off, and the Chartist movement had several splintered movements. I mean, I've already talked about some wanted to do the whole moral thing, and some people just wanted to go straight in and cause a riot. Well, we've got the same problem here. Some people wanted the constituencies to be split in terms of inhabitants, and some voters. I think I probably go towards the voters side of things. You want an equal amount of voters, definitely. Point number five, which is quite jarring to us in this generation, but I can make sense of it. They wanted MPs to be paid. And the reason that would be is so that the position of an MP could be taken up by more people than the aristocracy. Because if your job was an unpaid job, then you'd need family money. You need old money to take care of you. So that's why they were like, no, get MPs a wage, And then any Tom, Dick and Harry can become an MP. Do you know what I mean? That was their overall. And I get it. I do get that. I understand it. And number six, voting should be by secret ballot, which, to be honest, I thought it always was. So that's a no-brainer to me. If I was in Parliament, I'd have been like, well, number six is okay. Do you know what I mean? In my opinion, they're all right. But looking at it from a Tory or a Whig, you'd be like, well, number six is fine. I don't want my mate knowing who I'm voting for. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, all of this shit got shot down. And you're going to think, well, then why teach it? Because it's just a failure. But the fact is, we almost had it. And they had the right idea. It's just that they were in a time where they didn't have as much democracy as we have now. We have a little bit more agency now. So I feel like if we take their way of doing things with the agency that we have now and apply the two together, we could genuinely, you know, cause some sort of political reform. I don't know what kind of, I mean, I can think of a few things. But you know, yeah, like I just thought it's really important to teach people. It's not all, you don't have to throw tantrums to get what you want. You can do it in an organized way. And if they can organize themselves in a time before telephones, then we can certainly organize ourselves now in a time where we have mass communication with the internet and such. Do you know what I'm saying? So that was the reason why I wanted to talk about Chartism today. I thought it was really important. And there's a few people that I've mentioned there, they lived very fascinating lives. Genuinely, do go look them up. They're brilliant. So yeah, that was Chartism. This has been quite a long episode and quite draining on me. So, like, my voice is hurting and everything. So I'm going to go and edit and then post it up. But obviously, hit me up on Facebook, Twitter, email me at shellversusuniverse@gmail.com. That's shellvsuniverse@gmail.com. You can tell me your opinions on things I've said. You can give me topics to discuss. Anything really. Hit me up. You can send voice notes. No, that I've already said all this. Because I made you wait so long for this episode, I'm going to drop another one in a couple of days' time because I feel like it's fair. So, I guess I'll see you then. Thanks for listening. Bye.